And speaking of cool things coming up at Topo this week, we are joined now in the studio by Max Orr, who heads up Carolina Public Humanities on campus for another weekly round of Oh the Humanities, taking a look at scholarship, events, and research in the humanities on campus here in Chapel Hill, humanities.unc.edu, the website. Max, how's it going?
Happy Monday. Happy Monday to you, too. I like the way that you have this, you know, special events with Mac Brown, but Aaron Keck gets a special time with Max. Instead of time with Max.
Yeah. So, Mondays with Max. There you
go. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I'm sure the entire listening audience is waiting for this very moment. So I always bring you gifts, Aaron, related to today's date. It was a tough one, finding anything at all remotely related to today's date. So we're just going to have to pretend that it's related
to today's
date.
That's fine. Yeah.
On September 16th, in 1620, the Mayflower set sail for the New World.
Oh, interesting.
It took over 2 months to get to what we know as Plymouth Colony, Plymouth Rock.
September feels like a weird time to start that voyage,
right? Yeah,
it
does, doesn't it? And it was not a great ship, apparently.
Yeah.
It took a long time to get. It was really poorly built for what it was trying to do. So there you go.
The pilgrims were probably quite ill when they landed.
Indeed. Well, they made some progress. But
I'm trying to segue to our topic.
Yeah, I'm trying. I'm trying to figure this out. Yeah, they got ill, and then they figured out they all helped each other.
So, yes.
It's almost as though that they had some sort of care for each other.
Right.
And they cared about each other's
and
health.
And pooling their resources
to help each other
in a sort of insurance kind
of
thing.
We are stretching hard here, Aaron.
We're stretching exactly as hard as we usually do.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Well, our topic is healthcare. We have this incredible event coming up, the Humanities Happy Hour, which is, of course, every third Wednesday at Back Bar at Top of the Hill. And this Wednesday, we have an old friend coming back who has been done many talks on healthcare. And unfortunately, I feel like one of these days we're going to invite our guest to give the final talk because it's all figured out. But it doesn't ever seem to be the case. Our guest today is John Oberlander. He's professor and chair in the School of Social Medicine at the UNC Medical School. He's also in health management and health policy at the Gilling School for Public Health. Our resident expert on all things healthcare politics, healthcare reform. Welcome, John Oberlander.
Thank you. I thought I was going to be on with Mac Brown, so this is really a surprise.
Well, I was about to ask you a bunch of questions about football, so maybe it'll work out best.
I can talk a lot of football, actually.
There you go. I know Aaron can, too. We could just go all football. Well, I'm gonna pass on that.
Okay. Good night, everybody.
Let me just ask you, John, how long have you been working on healthcare policy and the politics of healthcare reform?
Are you trying to age me right
away? No, I'm not trying to age you. I'm just trying to get a sense.
Days, weeks.
I did refer to you as an old friend to the program.
Great. So my first experience with healthcare was taking a healthcare politics class as an undergraduate when I was here at UNC. In the 1980s, it's kind of sketchy in my memory, but I think that first class was in the spring of 1988, and I took it with Professor Joel Schwartz, who was very well-known professor, famous teacher in the political science department. I had been studying Middle Eastern politics up until that point. I figured everything was solved there, so I would go try my luck with healthcare. And actually, the way I wound up in the class, you know, in the old days, which you probably don't remember, Max, we used to not have computers to register. We used to have to go down to the gym and have these sort of cards you would have to get in order to get into classes. And I couldn't get into a really popular class Joel taught on the Soviet Union, which existed then. Mm-hmm. And so I wound up in his comparative healthcare class. And so I've been working on this since 1988.
Wow. I asked you that not to age you, but just to think about how long this sort of intractable problem. I mean, we have solved the Middle East, that's right. But I mean, this one seems completely intractable, a domestic issue. Have you seen movement, and where is, obviously, Obamacare, I put the big scare quotes around the Affordable Care Act, was a big change. How do you see these incremental improvements or changes that are going on? And I guess we're gonna ask you the big questions about the future, but in terms of where we are to today, compared to 1988, what changes have you seen that have been really substantive?
Well, I'm going to go back even further. The first proposal for national health insurance in the United States actually dates back a century ago, all the way to 1916. So as a country, we've been at this. This is literally our 100 years war over healthcare reform. And on the one hand, if you want to be glass half empty, we still have the most inefficient, unequal, expensive arrangement for delivering health insurance. I'm not going to call it a system because that implies logic and reason. We don't really have that. So we have the most expensive, inefficient, wasteful arrangement for health insurance in the world. On the other hand, we have had a lot of progress. The enactment of Medicare and Medicaid in 1965 transformed American health policy. And of course, tens of millions of Americans rely on those programs today. In the late 1990s, we enacted the Children's Health Insurance Program. Mm-hmm. And also in the 1990s, we greatly expanded Medicaid eligibility for pregnant women and children. Terrific progress. And the Affordable Care Act is a complicated case. My take on it, and we're coming up on its 10th birthday, and those of us who have had birthdays with a zero at the end know that it's time for reflection. So at 10, I think what you can say about the Affordable Care Act is that in certain respects, it has represented tremendous progress. Insurers can no longer discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions. If you live in a state that's expanded Medicaid and we don't, and you're low income, your options for affordable health insurance are much better than they were a decade ago. So there's been lots of tremendous progress. On the other hand, there are lots of problems with Obamacare. And even though the law is formally entitled the Affordable Care Act, the fact is for millions of Americans, health insurance is still unaffordable.
Mm-hmm. What hasn't changed since you took that class in 1988, you said? What was said in that class that you could still say today?
Well, when I took that class in 1988, and I went into that class knowing nothing mm-hmm. about health policy, Professor Schwartz told us that we were the only rich democracy in the world with a large uninsured population, and that was true. Off the top of my head, I would guess there were around close to 30 million uninsured Americans back then, and it grew to close to 50 million mm-hmm. before the Affordable Care Act. We were told in 1988 that we had the most expensive medical care in the world, and we still have the most expensive medical care in the world, and we spend twice as much per capita than our poutine-eating, hockey-playing neighbors to the north of Canada. But what has changed is back then we just assumed that because we spent so much money that we had the best quality medical care in the world. Now, the quality of American medicine at its best is terrific. We provide a lot of acute medical care that is absolutely phenomenal. It makes a difference in people's lives. But there has been a lot of research in the last quarter century showing that the quality here is inconsistent as it is in other countries. So long story short, we already had two problems. Now we've got three.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm really interested in the, at least the debate seems to have changed. This concept of the Overton window, this notion of mm-hmm. certain things that people used to talk about as being realistic options. To hear on the Democratic debate stage that the fight is really over public option or Medicare for all, it seems like the window is a lot wider open for reform than it has been in the last 20 years. Would you say that's true?
I think the window is open to a broader set of ideas. I think that's right. And one of the ironies is the Affordable Care Act was built on the model of expanding private insurance and Medicaid. And here we are a decade into the Affordable Care Act, and candidates for president from the party that enacted the Affordable Care Act are instead talking about expanding Medicare and Medicare for all. And really, it's a return to the original vision of Medicare. When Medicare was enacted in 1965, its architects thought that it would not be a program for older Americans, but it would start with them. And then it would cover children next, and eventually everybody. In other words, the original vision of Medicare was Medicare for all. It was not realized, didn't mm-hmm. happen that way, and it fell out of favor for many decades, and it's back in a way in this presidential debate that it has not been at least since the 1970s, and maybe even more so than then.
That's an interesting kind of political, almost strategic move to start with older Americans and then go to children next and then reach out to everyone. That's an approach that I haven't heard in this debate. Would that be more kind of politically viable today in the way that it might have been seen in the 60s?
Well, back to football, if we may. The playing field is more crowded now.
Right.
Because now you've got
CHIP, but
the Children's Health Insurance Program. You've got Medicaid, which really became the platform for low-income kids mm-hmm. in the 80s. In 90s, but if you imagine a different history, if you imagine that Medicare had been expanded to children in the late 1960s or early 1970s, we might have turned out very differently, but here we are.
Yeah.
It's interesting about the, you know, the narrative and selling this politically, considering that now we have these options open. On the other side of the aisle, how is it that, I mean, this is a speculative question, how is it that the narrative of don't change anything can remain so strong? Is it really just fear of taxes and fear of big government is a strong enough narrative where people are going into debt for health for healthcare, even if they have healthcare, they're often not willing to use it because of copays and deductions, et cetera. So how is it that the countering narrative remains so strong, and what can we do to, I guess, open the window for those people?
Healthcare is a problem is a bipartisan issue. Americans, doesn't matter what political party you're in, have experienced problems with their insurance companies, problems with the cost of their insurance, rising deductibles, rising copayments. That's something that Americans feel of all political stripes. But the solutions to healthcare reform are partisan. And healthcare policy is divisive, and it's divisive because it's about the boundaries of government. Where should we set the role of government versus the role of markets? What is the responsibility of society versus the responsibility of individuals? And that leads to very different ideas about what to do. And when President Trump in 2017 and congressional Republicans, when they advanced their bill to repeal most of the Affordable Care Act and replace it with a Republican alternative, their alternative reflected Republican philosophy on healthcare, which, as in many issues, is quite different than Democratic philosophy on healthcare. So there is a strong partisan divide on this issue, and I think it's widening.
Speaking with John Oberlander again, we're talking about healthcare. He's going to be speaking at Humanity's Happy Hour, which is on Wednesday at Topo Back Bar, 6 to 7. Is that the time?
6
to 7 p.m.
Come early if you want.
Yep, humanities.unc.edu for more information on that and upcoming events. We've been talking about the politics of healthcare reform. In terms of the practicality, you've studied healthcare in the United States. You started studying comparative healthcare programs. What works? What if you had to just scrap everything and create the perfect healthcare program, what actually is the one that works the best?
Well, this is going to be so disappointing. I don't think there is one. Mm-hmm. You know, if we could get Harry Potter or some wizard out here and sort of do their thing, there is no one system that's perfect. All countries have problems. Canada has trouble. Germany, Japan, Great Britain, they all have problems. I think there are a lot of models that work better than our model. We have, everybody's got problems. We have a unique combination of problems. We're the only rich democracy in the world with a large uninsured population. We pay so much for medical care. We spend a lot of money on administration. So I think there are different ways to do this, and that's really what this debate in 2020 in part is about.
Great. You know, it's funny about, I remember I had suggested to you one of our last times where we were talking about healthcare, that Donald Trump just needs to flip a nationalist argument and about paying for other, paying for research and for pharma, and having pharma be able to charge Americans ridiculous amounts of money for drugs, whereas those same drugs are cost controlled in other countries. And I said, this is a perfect nationalist, yeah, America first argument. And surprisingly enough, Donald Trump said something to that effect a couple months after I had mentioned it. He took my idea. But nothing came
of
that.
So you're the
that.
One.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But nothing came of that. And I'm wondering, you know, how can you turn this into a narrative of, this will make America stronger if we're healthier?
Well, Brexit. I mean, kind of the same argument with Brexit. We need Brexit so that we can better bolster and support the National Health Service in Great Britain. Nothing really came of that either, but that was the argument that was made, right?
It absolutely is in our national interests that all Americans have access to quality, affordable health care. It's just we disagree over what that means, mm-hmm, and over what it requires. And healthcare reform, remember, we spend over $3.5 trillion on medical care in this country, over $10,000 per person. So when you're talking about healthcare reform, depending on what version of health reform you're talking about, it may require some redistribution of those funds, and it may require some people to pay more, and it may require some people or a lot of people, depending on the plan, like Medicare for All, to switch health insurance. And while people in the abstract, I think, would agree that it is, as you now the Trump whisperer have said, Max, it is in our natural interest to have health care for all, the consensus falls apart when we get to the solutions.
I got to wrap up this conversation again. 6 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday at Topo Back Bar's Humanities Happy Hour. John Oberlander is going to be speaking there. You've been hearing him. Max Orr, final thoughts, other upcoming things that people want to know
about? I've got two great events. In addition to our Happy Hour on tomorrow at Flyleaf Books, we're continuing our PPE series with Luke Bovens, who's going to be giving a wonderful talk on gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. We got our finger on the pulse. And then our military history series kicks off also on Wednesday at 2 o'clock at Flyleaf Books, and Joe Glathar will be giving a concise history of the U.S. military. So, should be fun.
Sounds
Come
good.
On by. Humanities.unc.edu.
Is the website. Go there and get more information. Max Orr, John Oberlander, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.